Succession number 23329, reel number 10.
Cal Younger, reel 10.
This trip we travelled in a proper train again, as we had from Gulag Luft, just with the windows wired up, leaving a gap of about 4 inches. We were very interested in railway traffic. We saw trains coming from the Russian front, we were trying to estimate the number of wounded. There were nurses going among the patients, I think we were quite impressed by their solicitude. We didn't really expect solicitude in Germany somehow, but they were all human like us. The journey wasn't very pleasant. The heat was on, and we were told it couldn't be turned off. The guards were standing a few feet apart along the corridor, a lot of them smoking on the sly. And lots of women and children waved to us, thinking that we were on our way to Stalingrad, or that we were German heroes anyway. Poland, we went through Poland. It looked very bleak and melancholy. We were very interested in everything we could see, really, from the train. We saw both a concentration camp and an ordinary prisoner of war camp. They didn't look very different. There were the familiar barbed wire and groups of people bashing the circuit, as we called it. At one point, when we were stopped at a station, we saw people being pushed into cattle trucks, whole families of them, and they were crushed in, standing room only, and I don't think the children could have had a chance. They were Jews on their way to one of the concentration camps. We saw one of the guards, and he was pale and horrified, and he just said in English, "Bad." We had 2 days in the train. And eventually we crossed the Niemen River at Tilsit and went northwards towards Memel. But Heidekrug was a few kilometres short of that. It was almost on the Lithuanian border. And we had to march from the station eventually we arrived at this new camp. We were actually able to lie in green grass while we waited for searching and counting and being drafted to various huts. we could see the main compound. There was long green grass there too, but within a very short time there wasn't a single blade of grass. The topsoil was reduced to the grey dust that we knew so well. Cut it there. Yes, we were eventually led into the camp by a German officer who was quite elderly, and or seemed so to us anyway. He was around 70, and he had eyes that looked in different directions. And somebody said, "Just look at that cross-eyed old bastard." And immediately the German officer came back, "Gentlemen, please, he really ought not to be so disrespectful to an old man." It was a gentle rebuke, and I think it went home. But he became known as Cross Eyes, or sometimes Jiminy Cricket. He was a mathematician, I believe, not a very effective officer, and he didn't stay with us for very long. But he did like to meet some of our mathematicians. We had some very clever people in ranks, and they used to discuss their mathematical problems with poor old Jiminy Cricket. The camp was not finished when we arrived. There was just the one lager called A Lager. Two other lagers were being built adjacent to the main one. A Lager had four brick barracks, each with nine rooms, holding about 60 people. Also some wooden huts, two cookhouses, and two latrines. They were long brick buildings. There were already about 100 new prisoners in the camp. They'd been sent direct from Dulag Luft, and they had expected the camp to grow slowly, but were rather bewildered when a couple of thousand men suddenly landed on them. Go about George Kirk now. Don't think we need that particularly. There were several among the new prisoners from 460 Squadron, among them George Kirk, who was to become a lifelong friend. His mother wrote to him shortly afterwards and reminded him that as a small boy he'd once built a cage for his dog, and she had reproached him with, "How would you like to be caged like that?" And he said, "Mother, I'd love it." He didn't love it now. He was a very handsome boy, really. He was very young, and he dressed as a beach girl when we had a sort of gala day called the Fliege Jockey Day, Flieger being German for flyer. And we had a fancy dress parade. And there were races with all kinds of strange steeds ridden by gaily clad jockeys. This may sound rather more cheerful than in fact it was really, but it was a nice little break. There were sideshows, and the most popular was one run by the Scots, who invited people to come and see if they had any Scottish blood. The commandant attended with Dixie, and they backed their fancies at the tote, and the commandant really enjoyed his day, and at the end he paid from his own pocket for every man in the camp to have a bottle of sarsaparilla. If he'd made it beer, he would have been popular for the rest of his life. Cigarette parcels, I suppose, in a way. Cigarettes were the camp currency. It didn't matter whether you smoked or not, you needed cigarettes. People, of course, were betting on the races and cigarettes. At the time, I didn't really... I couldn't afford to bet on the horses, because I'd given most of my supply to the new chaps from 460 Squadron, because the cigarette parcels I had received all came from 460 Squadron. Apparently, their kits, not personal belongings, but whatever they left in their kit that could be auctioned by the others, was auctioned, and the money went to providing cigarette parcels for members of the squadron who were in Germany. So I was very happy to hand over my cigarettes, because they weren't going to get theirs for quite a while, whereas my supply was coming through. This time, Godfrey Loder had pinched a window strap from the train, and this was regarded as initially as sabotage, but the German major who actually sentenced him took a more sympathetic attitude and just sentenced him to 3 weeks solitary confinement. Right. Shortly after our arrival, the adjoining lager, K Lager, was completed, and the prisoners at Stalagluft 1 were sent down to this lager, and among them were my friends T.B. Miller, the Canadian, who was my combine partner that I mentioned earlier, and Peter Buttigieg, the Maltese escape veteran. The two of them had attempted escape several times at Stalagruf 1. I might say that Peter Buttigieg is is still a great friend of mine, and Tom Miller was up to his death 3 years ago. Two of the chaps in D5, which was my room, or barrack, began a tunnel right in the middle of the room. They cut a trapdoor in the floor, and the idea was to drive the tunnel into the unfinished compound, which was later to be occupied by the Americans. Between the floor and the ground, there was enough space for them to push freshly dug soil, but eventually the floorboards began to rise, and the soil had to be carried out elsewhere in kit bags or any other receptacle that we could find, but it wasn't good enough. The Abwehr officer and a number of ferrets soon turned us out of the barrack and demolished the tunnel. While the tunnel was going on, John Valentine practiced the violin, making no audible progress. We banished him to the little room at the end of the barrack, which was the night latrine, and even from that he was banished again. He took refuge in the cookhouse, but the cooks chucked him out of there. Nobody wanted him in the latrines, and in the end he parked himself in a brick incinerator, and nobody really knew where the sound was coming from. Right. The Germans then dug a ditch between the warning wire and the fence to prevent further tunneling. And eventually, when the Americans occupied the compound, then neither the wire nor the ditch was very important. Somehow the ditch acquired water, and there were minute fish and frogs, and one of the Canadians developed a taste for frog legs, and he was able to supplement his menu quite considerably. At Stalaglove 3, we had, as I explained earlier, had our own Red Cross parcels, and we cooked our own food in a little kitchen at the end of the barrack block. At Heiderkrug, there was no provision for individual cooking, so all the food from Red Cross parcels, well, not quite all, one was left with things like powdered milk and jam, if there was jam, but the meats, meat roll, that sort of thing, went to the cookhouse and usually came back in hash mixed up with the potato, and it got pretty monotonous. Okay. The monotony was compensated for, however, by a reduction in chores. Although we did have to take our turn at the cookhouse peeling whole barrels of potatoes, apart from that, Dixie Dean certainly was pleased, and so were the doctors, because they felt that the irregular eating habits adopted by some of the prisoners, particularly those who more or less wolfed down a whole parcel when they got it instead of spreading the food out over the week, was not good for the health of the camp generally. As for entertainment, a New Zealander, born in this country actually, but brought up in New Zealand from the age of 10, named Frank Hunt, created an orchestra which became about 60 strong and was an exceedingly good orchestra. Frank, after the war, married a New Zealand pianist named Jean Anderson, who's a very well-known teacher of the piano today, and their son is Gordon Hunt, a world-renowned oboist. Anyway, Frank started with a 32-piece camp orchestra. Many of them were very ordinary players to begin with, but with the opportunity they had, they improved immeasurably. There were two bands in the sense of the big bands that were popular in those days, run by Johnny Fender and Stan Parris, and they were very popular. And nevertheless, straight plays were voted the best entertainment in the camp. And just as an example, Grass in June, Love in a Mist, The Ringer, For the Love of Mike, Front Page, all were given. And the theatre community mostly lived in one barrack, and they rather took on the clothes of show business people. One of the female stars was Roy Dotrice, who was later to become a very famous actor, and his daughter Michelle is also very well known. The theatre had its own seamstresses, their own dress designers and stage designers, writers, and they really provided a lifeline to most of the prisoners. Even with stage door Johnny's come to see the female leads. Debating was another very popular pastime, and I think this was largely the work of Eddie Alderton, and George Higginbotham was another. They were also both involved in the education department, if you could call it that. In fact, it became known as the university, the Barbed Wire University, and people even managed to take degrees before the end of the war. There were 54 lecturers, and they covered some 40 subjects. you could learn almost any language, and there were classes ranging from metallurgy to hotel management, and even Phil Isles, who had been a taxi driver, used to teach the knowledge. So that was pretty exciting, I think, and gave many people an opportunity that stood them very well in years to come, such as one lad who had left school at 14, ended his career as a headmaster of a big school. Among the people who took part in both the debating society and as actors was Peter Thomas, who became a member of the Heath cabinet in later years and is now Lord Thomas of Gwydir. In the debating society, Peter Thomas often was opposed by an Australian named James, AFP James, who was an extraordinary character. He claimed he'd been shot down deliberately by one of his own squadron. He was a Spitfire pilot, and he claimed all sorts of things and could never be proved wrong. Years after the war, he was imprisoned in China for several years, and then was eventually carried by stretcher across the border into the territories at Hong Kong, making a big splash in the papers. But he was a very good debater, and he knew how to get under Peter's skin so that the debates attracted a much larger audience than they might otherwise have done. But there were some very clever people. Another was Michael Custance, who was later a very high-flying civil servant, and Cyril Ainslie, later to be chief reporter on the Express. These people were idols, really, and I sat in the audience as I would in perhaps a London theatre, never dreaming that after the war many of these stars were to become close friends, but at that time they were a world away. I pursued my own interests, read a lot, I studied economics, did many, well, I suppose the number of drawings I did ran into thousands, and I really was just one of the bunch, really, living my own life, taking advantage of the entertainment and the education that offered. Helping with escape in that I would draw maps, And we all were involved in disposing of dirt from the soil from the tunnels. Which reminds me that two of our chaps, Jack Catley and Derek Smith, thought up